As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Muddy Knees Media.
The heating's on, it's getting darker earlier and earlier, so why not cheer yourself up this November with a subscription to The Athletic for just £1 a week. For only 100 of your English pence every 7 days, you'll get unrivaled analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, plus a breaking news service and ad-free versions of all of The Athletic's podcasts. Sign up today at theathletic.com/totally.
Totally Football Show. Today, on a big midweek for important results abroad, we survey a Champions League round that topically had no real precedent, with a record-breaking 62 goals scored on match day 3. From Liverpool Atakanta v Atalanta to Başakşehir against Başakşehir incompetence in Istanbul. Plus, we do Man City Liverpool, celebrate the fixture computer, discuss PPV, and look at football jargon worldwide and more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Hello, you. It's the 5th of November, day one, of course, of the new lockdown in England, day two of knockdown in other places. And we're joined by Duncan Alexander.
Hello, James.
Tom Williams.
Hello, James. And can I just say the good people of Wales have already been locking down for a good fortnight.
That's true, actually. Sorry about that, good people of Wales. Also with us, Sasha Gurionov.
Morning, James, and USA.
Well, indeed. Always, Sasha, always. A big show today. You'd need two pods for all this content with a big weekend coming up in the Premier League and just finished the highest scoring midweek ever in the Champions League group stage in its current format. Briefly, did you have a good time?
Yeah, I mean, great to have all the goals flying in. The one thing I find with it is that it makes it hard to properly follow any one game in particular. Mm. My Champions League setup is generally the game I want to watch on the big telly. And then the goal show, of course, on the tablet. But when there are so many goals going in all the other games, sometimes you realise you've not actually watched the game that you were trying to watch. But there are worse things to have to put up with in life.
Tom, just for you, here's a roundup of the key points midweek. Two goals scored midweek, three in Istanbul, as Man United got a Başakşehir here. Elsewhere in that group, Paris Saint-Germain got stuck in a hotel lift.
Ça va? Faut vous sauter tous en même temps, le mec, il a dit.
Then saw too many flaws as they went down 2-1 to RB Leipzig. On Tuesday, Real Madrid beat Inter in a 3-2 thriller. Man City put 3 past Olympiacos. Liverpool put 5 past Atalanta. And Gladbach put 6 past Shakhtar. Bayern also peppered Salzburg with 6 in their 14th straight Champions League win.
Hernandez den Ball zum 6-2 ins Netz.
While at Porto, Marseille lost their 12th straight game in the competition, leaving manager AVB to say this. To be weak and play like in the Champions League, you need to be in the Champions League. We're here, and we played like Also this midweek, Chelsea grabbed another clean sheet v Rennes. Haaland got another brace, that's 14 goals in 11. Barca scraped by a Kiev side battling coronavirus, while Juve battled another virus, Ferencvaros, 4-1, with Ronaldo back and Morata this time staying onside. Woof. Well, standout moment, Sasha.
Jota for me. Standout moment, hat-trick. I'm afraid Atalanta set up very nicely for him, but I thought it was a brilliant, brilliant Liverpool performance. And I know they weren't the highest scorers in Europe this midweek, but I think it's probably because they declared after 55 minutes.
Like, you know, some people, we're 5-0 up, we'll call this one a win, eh? Popular. Duncan, what stood out for you?
Man United and essentially the lack of Man United, particularly for the first goal, where I think the closest player to the United goal was Matic, and he was approximately about 75 yards.
So that was, I mean, for anyone who missed it, and I, to be honest, never really understood it until after the show what had happened. A short corner for United, which they eventually lose, and then Visca looks up and sees the only, well, open bar in all of Europe, and hoofs it downfield, and then there's this foot race.
Well, yeah, between a 35-year-old man who Stoke once refused to sign because his knees didn't work, and then he went on to play for many, many more years, and Matic. And, yeah, it was, I mean, it was so bad that if it had happened in a computer game, if it was in FIFA, they'd have had to release a patch, I think, because it was just like you never see that. People were saying, would you see that in under-10s, under-11s football? Not really, because in that level of football, you always have one big kid that just hangs around the halfway line. And I think, yeah, so extraordinary. And I think, you know, Ollie took the blame himself afterwards. But, yeah, I mean, one of the most extraordinary goals I've seen for a long time.
We'll have a lot more Man United chat because that's what we do, right, listener? But Tom, do want to mention the stat you cited midweek. United mustering a single shot on target from open play against Basaksehir here, who, let's remember, had been done by both PSG and Leipzig coming into this. No points, no goals prior to this clash.
Yeah, one shot on target from open play, which was Anthony Martial's goal. There was the very gentle, curly, floaty free kick from Bruno Fernandes in the second half. And then there was that chance right at the end, which actually came from an Istanbul Başakşehir player turning it back towards his own goal. And that was it. And United dominated possession in the second half and put all of their attacking players on the pitch at various points and got nowhere near equalising, really, apart from that quite fortuitous last chance. And it was remarkable to see United have so much possession and to have so much attacking talent on the pitch, and to fail to create a single chance of no. And I think it just goes back to what we seem to say about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer every time we discuss him on this show, that when there's space for his team to attack into, United are brilliant. They're one of the best teams in Europe. And when there isn't space, they are absolutely hopeless.
Well, an evening which was supposed to have seen them take a commanding lead in the group instead now sees them level with the team they'd beaten a week before, RB Leipzig, who themselves got that 2-1 win over Paris Saint-Germain. What's the reaction been, Tom, to this performance in France? Is there a lot more pressure now on Thomas Tuchel?
There is, yes. It's not helped by the fact that he continues to make quite baffling decisions, the latest of which is his stubborn insistence on playing Danilo Pereira, his new holding midfielder, as a centre-back, and playing Marquinhos, his centre-back, as a holding midfielder, which he's done for the last few games. And Danilo Pereira actually said after the game last night, he was asked in the mix zone, you know, how do you feel about this? And he said, well, look, I'm not a defender. I'm a midfielder. I'll play there if I have to. What works in Tuchel's favour is that last season was the best season in PSG's history, albeit a weird COVID-19 curtailed season. They won all four of the domestic trophies. They reached the Champions League final for the first time in their history and lost narrowly to Bayern Munich. But clearly Tuchel and Leonardo don't get on. You know, Tuchel's been asked about his future. His contract runs out at the end of the season. He knows that PSG can't afford to sack him, both financially, because it'll cost them about €10 million in compensation, and because you can't sack the guy who's taken the club to its first ever Champions League final a matter of months after doing that. So there's just this sort of this uncomfortable holding pattern. Tuchel is going to see the season out. He'll probably win Ligue 1 again. What might change is that they might not reach the Champions League knockout rounds, and then the pressure really would build. But yeah, he's not looking particularly comfortable this morning.
Well, indeed, and they're not looking comfortable, as you say, in the group. Man United and Leipzig on 6 points, there on 3. Although they could turn that around in 3 weeks' time with the return leg against Leipzig on Paris.
Maybe one bright spot for Paris Saint-Germain is Moise Kean. Absolute handful yesterday against Leipzig. They really, really struggled to contain him. I mean, he was... I mean, thanks to him, there should have been probably a couple of goals up at halftime. And look, he's for a player who hasn't really scored for a year, he seems to have really hit the ground running there. Do you think this is down to Tuchel, or is it just Kane just needed some more better players around him than Everton?
I think it's probably more the latter, to be honest, in that he's playing for a team who create lots of chances for him. And he's also, he's showing people what a talented footballer he is, which is something we didn't see all that much at Everton. And to the point that Mauro Icardi is out with injury currently, but his form has been awful all year, to the extent that before the end of last season, he'd lost his place in the team to Edinson Cavani. And I suspect that when Icardi does return from injury, I think Keane will probably still get picked ahead of him because he's shown such great form of late.
Mm. Tuesday night in Madrid, as I mentioned, there was that outstanding Real Madrid win over Inter, which saw them move out of last place in the group and put the Nerazzurri into it. Possibly the most exciting bit was the incredible Barella assist for Inter's opener, the brilliant Barella assist. A big win all in all for Zidane, Tom.
Yeah, tough moment for Bayern Munich's coach with that Barella assist because he's no longer the most impressive flick in the Champions League.
It was a gorgeous back heel if you haven't seen it. Seek it out, listener. Colin Miller, by the way, pointing out that Sergio Ramos scored his 100th goal for Real Madrid in that game. A classic Ramos header. His second goal of that 100-goal run was actually assisted by the man who's now his manager, Zinedine Zidane, which gives you an idea of the career arc we're talking about. And how about this? His first goal was assisted by Raul Bravo, who earlier this year, you may recall, was suspected of hiring a hitman to murder his former Olympiacos teammate, Darko Kovacevic. So there you go. Anyway, Sasha, let's talk about the Russians. Three of them in the Champions League. Not entirely sure how that happened. So far, they've had 9 games, no wins. Is it 4 goals scored?
Well, it's 4 draws and 5 defeats.
Yeah.
And this is the first and last time Russia will have 3 teams in the Champions League group stage because after this season, due to the drop in the coefficient, they will be down to 2, 1 straight in, 1 in the qualifying. And to be honest, like looking at this year's performance, I think 3 is probably 2 too many, or maybe 2.5 too many, because I think what the Russians have found is the quality in the league isn't great. And then when these players have to play every 3 days, the form, they just can't keep it up. So between them, the 3 Russian Champions League clubs have won 1 out of the last 15. So they can't even win in the league. So they're absolutely shattered. And I think you could kind of see that in the second half yesterday for Krasnodar and Seville. I mean, they were up against 10 men. They actually had a very decent first half. Berg, for an old man, gave Sevilla defenders a lot of problems, particularly Kunde. Kunde had to be subbed. And, Diego Carlos, who's supposed to be dead good, had a shocker as well. So first half, really, really good from Krasnodar. But second half, they just fell to pieces. And I think it generally shows that they're just knackered. And the quality of centre-back isn't there. And you could see how easy Chelsea beat them last week. So they're just not good enough. Lokomotiv gave it a bit of a better go. And, they were really positive against Bayern, who were perhaps not as switched on as they should have been. But Anton Miranchuk, Alexei's brother, Alexei, who's gone to Atalanta, but has played 10 minutes so far. His brother, Anton, twin brother, who is supposed to be less good, has actually now scored against Bayern and Atletico. And again, in the spirited performance, but they Atletico should have been out of sight in Moscow in front of 8,000 fans. But Guilherme had a really, really good game in Nets for Lokomotiv, which finally brings me on to Zenit, the big behemoth of Russian football. Is just so, there's just nothing to them at the moment. Perhaps Simak isn't the best coach. Depleted Lazio side, recovered well, helped by a Lovren slip. But again, this is a sort of game Zenit should have been expected to win. They only managed to draw. So I think the best the Russians can hope for maybe is one club in the Europa League at the end of all this.
Lazio, as you say, a depleted Lazio side who got that point away in St. Petersburg Wednesday night. They've got Juventus coming up this weekend. There's a lot of controversy about how 3 of their players who couldn't feature for them in match day 2 a week ago or this week in St. Petersburg. I'm talking about Luis Alberto and Ciro Immobile, 36 goals in the league last season, did manage to play in the extraordinary result they had in between those 2 matches in Serie A at the weekend when they were 3-2 down after 94 minutes but managed to win the game 4-3 in the 98th, which is a terrific result. There's now being an inquiry, or there's an inquiry now underway in Italy about the private test that Lazio did to clear their players to feature in the Serie A match, one of them scoring, Ciro Immobile, while UEFA was saying, no, look, you're still positive. So they've basically come, they've taken away the swabs. There's a big inquiry about whether the Lazio doctor has said asymptomatic is the same thing as being healthy. Anyway.
Did he say I can see asymptomatic play. And they went, asymptomatic? Yeah, fine, cool. Get on.
As I say, they have Juventus coming up this weekend, who will probably be awarded another 3-0 on the back of all of this. Anyway, Sasha, miserable stuff with the Russians. Let's cheer you up with a little bit more on Liverpool's performance away in Bergamo. We previewed this on Tuesday by saying Atalanta's not a team you want to visit when you've got a shaky back line. But bizarrely, although you have the second worst defence in the Premier League, you're still yet to concede in the Champions League.
Yes, and I think, I mean, there's obviously a bit of luck in this, because remember Ajax, you know, hit the post. There's got goal line clearance from Fabinho. Mitchell had a couple of one-on-ones. Obviously Zapata hit, I think, hit the angle of the crossbar in the post already at 5-0. But I think what helped Liverpool is the general, I think, attitudes towards the game here, which in effect, I think, protected the centre-backs because they were just so positive elsewhere on the pitch. And they didn't play like a team who was thinking, inexperienced centre-back partnership. They just played the normal game. And I think also what Atalanta did, I think it's interesting the way that Klopp, before the game, spoke about Atalanta being a bit like Leeds. And I think this man-to-man marking eventually let Atalanta down, because if you look at the way Liverpool scored the first goal, Trent Alexander-Arnold draws a player from Curtis Jones, who draws a player out to the defensive line, and then Jota immediately goes into that gap, and you can see Curtis Jones actually pointing to him, just go there. And this is when he actually, you know, Palomino can't do anything with him. And then also in that situation, you know, Jota is basically being assaulted, yet he is producing a really fantastic fine finish. I think he destroyed Hatebu for the second. I think the general Liverpool the approach, I think, eventually spooked Atalanta, but in a way that they completely lost all shape. And, you know, then, you know, you have Salah running from his own goal, and, you know, Liverpool just played around him. And I think it is really, really impressive that Liverpool managed to switch it on in this, in a crucial game like this, because I think it's important for Liverpool as well to qualify as quickly as possible from the Champions League groups, given, you know, how tight the schedule is. But also, you know, Jota himself, I think when I was on the pod just after Liverpool signed Jota, I was actually more excited about him than I was about Thiago, just given his profile. I could see him fitting into that front line. But I think, I don't think really anyone expected for it to be this smooth, because, you know, you've seen other strikers in Liverpool, like, you know, Origi or Minamino, who just don't, you know, there isn't a seamless fit into the front line after many, many years for Origi. But, you know, Jota, it's like he's always played there. Of course, maybe you could say that Wolves played very, you know, intense football, and I think this is something that Klopp alluded to. But the way he understands when to move, how to move, you know, the interaction with other players, it's the skill on the ball, the composure, you know, the way after the game, you know, he's being asked, are you playing the best football of your career? No, I just playing the best team of my career. You know, very level-headed. And I think this is, you know, they signed an absolute gem here.
6 goals in 4 games now. The man that they bought instead of Timo Werner, pretty much. And a lot of people asking about whether Firmino gets back into the team, given Jota's form. Lovely quote from Klopp after the match. He says, the world is sometimes a bad place. In the moment when somebody is shining, we immediately speak about another player who has played what feels like 500 games in a row. Without Bobby Firmino, we would not even be in the Champions League. Still, you must be a bit dizzy as a Liverpool fan. You know, one week you're getting beaten 7-2 by Villa. Another one, you're destroying Atalanta 5-0.
I think Trent's words before Atalanta on Villa were quite important. He said, you know, it humbled them as a team. And I think you could feel that after that 7-2, once they went for an international break, returning, they actually had a very good performance against Everton. It feels like the whole team is concentrating again. And I think maybe the fact that Van Dijk's out, everyone else maybe feels that they have to really, really lift their game. Or, of course, I think it is important as well to see Alisson back. I think Alisson makes a huge difference, and he's only conceded, I think, 2 goals in 4 games. You know, whenever he's called upon, like, say, Mitchell, and he makes a crucial save or forces the striker to commit a mistake. He had a very solid game against Atalanta. So I think with Alisson returning as well, I think you could see that the top performers, I think, are back in the team. Plus, you have the new blood like Jota and perhaps with Thiago to come in as well.
All right, well, top of the league, but facing Manchester City this weekend. We'll come on to that game very shortly. Tom, anything else from the midweek before we move on?
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on Chelsea briefly, and specifically their fullbacks. And I'm only going to compare them to Manchester United because I happen to watch both matches back to back. But what strikes you when you compare Chelsea to United is that the quality that Chelsea have in terms of the delivery they get into the box from their fullbacks is so high that it allows their other attacking players to basically leave things to the fullbacks in attacking areas. Whereas with United, yes, Luke Shaw set up Anthony Martial's goal with quite a nice cross, but both he and Aaron Wan-Bissaka are much more erratic crossers of the ball. And quite often, and we saw this in the latter stages against Istanbul Başakşehir last night, when the United fullbacks have the ball in high positions, they're just looking to offload it to someone else. They'd rather not have to take responsibility in those areas. And that means that United are basically robbed of what could be, two additional attacking weapons. One caveat there is that Alex Telles, in what he's shown so far for United, does have a wonderful left foot, so that might be about to change. But just to go back to Chelsea, I mean, Ben Chilwell has got a fantastic left foot. Rhys James, I don't think there's a better crosser of a ball than Rhys James in the Premier League. There are better passers. There are players who perhaps cross the ball with more variety, but there's a certain kind of cross, a sort of David Beckham-style cross, that Rhys James excels at. And as a football fan, when you see a player get into a position where you know they're going to put a cross into the box, there's something almost, I don't know, like slightly mystical about it. And as football fans, you know what a good cross looks like, but you can never guarantee you're going to see one. And Rhys James just seems to find the shape required every time he puts the ball into the box. We saw that with the goal that he set up for Tammy Abraham. And I think having him and Chilwell on the pitch is just an extra string to Chelsea's bow, on top of the fact they've got a lot of really talented attacking players as well.
Mm. All right, a big week for people putting crosses in boxes, of course. Not necessarily. But what about Trent? Isn't he the best crosser in the Premier League?
He's as good a crosser of the ball as Rhys James, and he's a better passer of the ball than Rhys James. He has more variety to his passing. But there's a certain kind of cross, a sort of leaning away from the ball with the instep around the corner of the penalty area. And I don't think there's anyone better than Rhys James. I think it is very often close to perfection.
I know what Tom means. And remember the last lockdown? Remember that one? The lockdown one, when we went through all the old Champions League seasons. And, it was the first time I watched some of those, matches for a long time, and just seeing Beckham in the late 90s, some of those crosses were just literally unplayable. Rhys James isn't quite there yet, but he's definitely got that within him.
Well, Man City, Liverpool awaits. But Sash, I think I have the feeling there's one thing more you want to throw our way from Europe.
Yeah, I would like to throw in some goalkeepers. Well, specifically one, Ruslan Nishirit. He is Dynamo Kiev number 3. Who, of course, I mean, this COVID situation, while it completely messes with all formations and tactics and teams, it does give players opportunity to shine, which they wouldn't otherwise. So this lad, he's 18. He signed a 5-year deal in January with Dynamo Kiev. He's only in the team because the two first-team goalkeepers, Boyko and Bushan, both got the COVID. Made his debut at the weekend against Dnipro, and they won 2-1. And then his second first-team match is at the Camp Nou against Messi. Mm-hmm. And
he did all right.
He did absolutely great. In that first half, I think at least 5 or 6 really high-quality saves, not just, to tick a box, as you said before, but they're properly well done. And also, I think a lot of these kids, when they first come through, I mean, if you look at the young goalkeepers, they're quite gangly, they're very ungainly, whereas Nesheret, is really well-built, really in control of his limbs and really good technique. And it's just really lovely to see, because he really kept his team in the game there. And had Ter Stegen not had a good game himself, Dynamo Kiev would have come away with something.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, maybe he'll get his chance in 3 weeks' time, or they'll get their chance in 3 weeks' time when they'll be welcoming Barcelona back to Ukraine. Anyway, for us, this weekend is looming, featuring, as I say, Man City, Liverpool. We'll be getting onto that next.
At Paddy Power, we know competition for the remote control can be fierce at the weekends. So, in order to give the non-football-loving occupants of your house something to do, here are some of our top suggestions. Go for a walk. Walk the dog. Walk to the shops. Go cycling. Cycle the dog. Recycle the dog. Just go! All very good options, we say. And that's not the only one. If one leg of your 4-plus-fold acca lets you down, get a free bet on all football leagues and all markets. Paddy Power.
Max free bet £10, min odds 1 to 5 on each leg, online exclusive, exclude shop bets, T's and C's apply, 18 plus, BeGambleAware.org.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
The Totally Football Shows and The Athletic are delighted to be supporting Football Aid for the months of October and November. Bid now at footballaid.com to get your hands on some incredible football memorabilia, including signed shirts from Steven Gerrard, Gianluca Vialli, Gareth Bale, and even Peter Crouch's boots. Find out more, get bidding, and support the cause at footballaid.com.
Man City hosting Liverpool Sunday 4:30. Listener, Man City with another victory midweek in the Champions League. Olympiacos were their opponents. They won 3-0. Fran Torres on the score sheet once again, and Gabriel Jesus back and scoring, which seems like it's big. This fixture in general, last two or three years, this was kind of a key match for the title. They weren't going to drop many points anywhere, so anything that they did drop here could be absolutely vital in their duel. Does it still have that kind of resonance, do you think?
It's still the biggest game in the Premier League based on the fact that these are the two best teams. But I think, as you pointed out there, you know, there's going to be a lot more drop points this season. And I don't think, and particularly as it's coming relatively early as well, that I don't think if either team loses this game, it's going to, you know, rule them out of the title. So, yeah, it's big, but it's also, I think that could even help the fixture a little bit because it's not going to be like, oh my God, if we lose, it's over. Right. Both teams will be able to try and, you know, keep their recovery. I think both of them, you know, Liverpool defence, as we've touched upon a lot, has been an issue, but City's attack has been, surprisingly, because, you know, you go back to the summer and everyone would have pointed out about their defending, but it's been there, it's been going forward that they've had issues. You know, they're averaging 1.3 XG a game in the Premier League this season, which is the lowest figure, not just under Guardiola, but since that data has ever been available. So, And I think that is partly because of the, you know, injuries to Jesus and Aguero and taking them time to come back. But it's definitely been an issue, yeah.
I mean, there's been a pattern in City games of late, which is that they tend to dominate matches and score early and then don't build on it. You look at their last four in the Premier League, they went ahead away at Leeds, dominated and then conceded and couldn't find a winner. They scored in the first half against Arsenal, couldn't add to it, so it ended up having, you know, a slightly tense end to the game, winning 1-0. At West Ham, they conceded first, despite playing quite well, and managed to get back into the game and equalise, but then couldn't build on it. And then again, last time out away at Sheffield United, score the opener, control the game, but not put it to bed. It's only really been in the Champions League that we've seen them score the sort of goals that their possession and their territorial dominance would suggest they deserve. And
right. And in that manner that we used to see from Man City in the past couple of seasons, that's the way they played against Marseille and Olympiacos.
Yeah, and it sort of feels like this has been the defining problem for like late era Guardiola, was that last season City, either they would put 5, 6, 7 goals past the team, or they would score one goal and just not be able to build on it, and they would remain vulnerable. And I think it is a big concern. I mean, as Duncan says, that Jesus and Aguero having been out has been clearly a factor in that, although, you know, they were around last season when the same sorts of thing were happening. But Jesus came back into the team and scored in midweek. It looks like Aguero might be back as well. And that should enable them to pose more of a goal threat than they have been of late.
I think it's slightly different this season. In last season, you're right, they were wasting a lot of chances. This year, they haven't really been creating that many good chances. And you do wonder whether it's a deliberate decision to, I mean, the idea that Pep's like, right, keep it tight at the back, lads, two banks of four, let's grind this out, seems unlikely. But you do wonder if there's been a slight concentration on defence.
Or maybe the fact that they've lost Leroy, well, they didn't have Sané last year, but certainly they did have David Silva.
I mean, it almost feels like there's a lot of pressure on Foden to actually provide that creative spark from midfield, which they've been lacking. But I also wonder, you know, as Duncan alluded, maybe Juan Murillo brought in some new ideas there to actually just make them tougher, to make them concede less, make them less open. Do they need a new number 10? I mean, they have a number 10 at left back, Zinchenko, who played midweek. Maybe he actually needs to play further up the pitch. But there certainly seems to be an emphasis to be tighter. Maybe this is off the back of them just being ripped open at stages in last season, which is something he looked at and said, you know, they need to improve on.
And there is a slightly a wider trend of the big clubs tightening things up a little bit. We've seen that in the last couple of weeks, if not since slightly earlier, that after that incredible flurry of freak scorelines in the first few weeks of the season, the big clubs in particular have started to tighten up, and we've certainly seen that with City.
it's after they got beaten by Leicester 2-5 we've seen really this approach. So I think maybe this maybe it is something to do with the reaction to that. Because also, if you remember, but a few years ago, Leicester got beaten 5-2 by Arsenal, tightened up the defence and won the league. Maybe they're taking the Leicester template.
The other thing with City is the fact that if they do concede, they never come back and win the game. So the first goal could be crucial at the Etihad on Sunday.
Yeah, and contrary to Liverpool, who've conceded first in each of their last two league games and gone on to win. So they sort of feel there's a slightly different dynamic with both teams. I tend to think that Liverpool have looked more like Liverpool of last season this season than City have looked like City of perhaps not last season, but this was a couple of seasons before. I feel like Liverpool are closer to where Jurgen Klopp would want them to be than City are to where Guardiola would want City to be. Whether that gives Liverpool an advantage, I don't know. But yeah, looking forward to it.
City have won the previous three meetings at the Etihad with Liverpool, including last season, a 4-0, which was the first game after Liverpool had won the title. So, you know, what's going to happen this time? Duncan?
Well, I think this is why Diogo Jota's inclusion in the team is quite a big call for Klopp, because I think, as Tom pointed out there, Liverpool, if they get ahead, it could be curtains for City. So, and he's in such good scoring form at the moment that I think you have to kind of back a player who's got the golden touch. I'd be interested to see what Sasha thinks. But, you know, I mean, the only thing I would point out with Jota is that his record of 7 goals in his first 10 games for Liverpool is level with Ronnie Rosenthal, who did miss the odd chance here and there. So it doesn't guarantee goals. But, yeah, I think, you know, he could be a key figure.
So I think that this is going to be an interesting call from Klopp, whether you play Firmino or Jota, or keep Jota as the, you know, this joker you bring up. Joker as in card joker, not a clown. this joker you bring out when you need an extra impetus to your attacking play. Because I think possibly what you also saw saying that 7-2 against Villa, and it's hard to blame Jota in that, but I think there was a general structural issue with defending space and with pressing. So perhaps against a more complex team like City, there would be more defensive responsibility on your attacking players, which is where Firmino is so important. So whilst I can see the argument for Jota, I'm wondering whether, because you really have to be at 100% in terms of tactical awareness against City, whether he might start with Firmino.
Fair. Tom, finally.
The only thing I'd say about Firmino and Jota is that, you know, you can't just whittle Firmino down to stats. It may be that Jota outscores him this season, but what Firmino gives you is that understanding with Mane and Salah that is very hard to quantify. As for how the game will go, I think if I had to pick a winner, I'd be more inclined to go for Liverpool than City, but I'm going to sit on the fence and say a draw.
Superb. Up next, we'll look forward to another mouthwatering Manx Mersey matchup this weekend.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
So, Liverpool are at Man City on Sunday. By a strange quirk of fate, their neighbours are also meeting this weekend because Everton host Man United. This is, of course, not fate, but the fixture computer, which is a similar kind of entity.
Has it got of Sky giving it a name? Yeah. Like, you know, when they have, like, you know, Red Letter Sunday.
Oh, the name for the day.
Northwest Regional Bragging Rights Monday or something.
Grand Slam.
But actually, I know they're on different days today, aren't they? So maybe
Yeah, they are. Yeah, that would be a Grand Slam Sunday.
Yeah.
Well, for example, Fixture Computer, the same entity that gave us on the 7th of November 2015, which is 5 years ago to the day on Saturday, possibly the greatest ever of these matchups. They have Bournemouth, the most southerly side ever in the Premier League, hosting Newcastle, the most northerly side ever in the Premier League. And on that same day, at Carrow Road, Norwich, the most easterly club in the Premier League ever, playing, yes, Swansea City, who are the most westerly side ever to ply their trade. You see where this is going.
They called it Compass Sabbath. I remember it really clearly.
Yeah.
I think of it a lot.
All right. Glenn Thompson, if you're listening, you are the technical architect at the company which does the fixture computer, feeds it the ticker tape and that, after consulting with the clubs, or the FA and the local authorities. Interestingly, this company does take requests from others to factor into its fixture decisions. For example, Nottingham Forest and Shrewsbury both had fixtures arranged around the Nottingham Goose Fair and the Shrewsbury Flower Show. Although in 2012, I note that when Birmingham City asked if they could have a home game on the 19th of April to celebrate Trevor Francis' birthday, they got a no. Computer said no.
But it's his birthday.
When, yeah, Okay, good. So when Wickham got promoted to the Football League in 93, they asked if the fixture computer would kindly give us a home game to start off with, you know, as a celebration. And cruelly, the fixture computer gave us Carlisle away, which seems a bit of a, a bit unnecessary.
They clearly enjoy their work at the fixture computer. All right, then. Well, spewing a ticker tape fashion out of its digital mouth this weekend is, as we mentioned, Everton's clash with Man United, which is going to mean a bit more Man United chat. We talk about Liverpool fans feeling dizzy. What about United's supporters? Well, let's dial one up. Nora Dean, aka Bearded Genius, is now on the line. Hey, Nora Dean, or Noz, how are you?
Quite well, considering. I mean, the good news is that an evil man is being usurped in the States, but it's less good news at Manchester United.
Nice tie-in with the other big issue, of course, on Wednesday, which we haven't really covered in full yet, the US election news. I did enjoy your tweet in the course of Wednesday's activities in response to Ching Lin's assertion that Oli was football's Trump. You said, say what you like about Trump, but at least he refuses to concede. Nicely done. You've had the banter years. We're now in the sort of middle of the Oli at the wheel meme era. And whilst it, you know, provides chuckles for some, I know that a lot of Man United supporters, like Rio Ferdinand, very upset after the game, kind of suggesting that Ollie should get in there and bang some heads together. What do you think needs to happen? Where is it all going to end? Is Poch going to come in, or is he going to swerve United? What's your take?
It's so convoluted and complicated at United because, again, like, what's the motivation and how will those in those positions of power react to what's happening? Because if you take Ed Woodward, like, what's the motivation for him? Is it better for him personally to get rid of Solskjaer and get another manager in, or will that reflect badly on him as yet another manager? There were so many short term fixes that Solskjaer was brought in as, like, we're gonna give him time, essentially. We're gonna sort of give him resources, give him time, and let him build his team over years. But what if you pick the wrong man? What if that person is just not suited to that position? And again, like, you talk about Rio Ferdinand and other ex United players and how they react. There's a strange dance going on where they will do everything apart from criticise Solskjaer. And again, that might have something to do with them being friends with him or sort of ex-colleagues. But it's a strange dance where they criticise everything but him. And really, I don't think that does him any favours, because that whole thing of treating him with kid gloves is, on one level, it's patronising. On the other level, that vacuum of criticism sort of brings in or invites other people to criticise him. It was interesting. Like, last night really felt like a turning point with the fans. Like, obviously, like, as a United fan, following a lot of other United fans on social media, you get different factions, some wanting to defend him, some sort of wanting him out, and you'd get different factions, and one faction is the group that will defend him no matter what, because he's a United legend. And it was interesting last night, you even saw those groups kind of turning on him, or at least saying he's not the right man for the job. And yeah, it was interesting it happened just after the election, because I was, like, watching it sort of thinking, oh, he's lost Salford. Oh, Withenshaw's gone now. It was like Greater Manchester slowly sort of losing confidence in Solskjaer.
One massive Man United success we should touch on, and that's Marcus Rashford. You're there in Manchester. How much impact is he having, and what's your take on the way he's approaching the various challenges that he's facing?
I mean, I just think it's incredible. Someone of that age, forget that he's a footballer, somebody of that age, 22 years old, taking on that responsibility. And again, like, you get all sorts of criticism from people who want to discredit his message, but he stays on message resolutely, doesn't let ego get in the way. When people are attacking him personally, he doesn't let that affect him. There's also been criticisms of, like, oh, does he compose every single tweet that comes out of his account? Does he sort of do all the research? In a sense, that does not matter. You can tell when he speaks in any interview how passionate he feels about it. He's lived through it. And this idea that he's got help, people helping him, good. That's what, I mean, we talk about leadership. He is showing leadership that our own government isn't. And part of leadership is having a team around you that's going to help you achieve your goals, and that's what he's doing. So it's incredible. And from the point of view of Manchester, because I'm from a working class part of Manchester. I'm from Crumpsall, which is not too dissimilar to Withenshaw, where he's from. And you do see it. You do see young people are inspired by him and are motivated by him. And it's just a little bit of it gives people a little bit of hope, and it gives people a little bit of pride in where they're from and what they can achieve.
Mm. Well, good that he's got one team around him that will help him achieve his goals, because on the field, that's not happening. Noz, brilliant stuff. Thank you so much for joining us today. Love your work. If anybody wants to follow you who doesn't, it's Bearded Genius. It's at Bearded Genius, isn't it? Is that a George Best reference?
It is. It is. Thank you for that, because it's a ridiculous name. It's not me. I do enjoy the fact that people always see a photo of me and say, "Well, you've not even got a beard," as if like right. The genius bit is okay.
Man United. That's enough about them. Everton. Still no Richarlison this weekend. It turns out to have been the crucial ingredient all along. What are their prospects at Goodison Park Saturday lunchtime as they take on Man United, having lost at Newcastle last time out?
Well, no Richarlison, who is still suspended, and we saw how much they missed him at St James's Park last weekend. But Luca Dean is back from his suspension, so that is at least half of Everton's left flank back in action, and it looks like James Rodriguez might be back as well. And he
with
is
his,
obviously
with his swollen testicle,
with his swollen slash slightly bruised testicle. Don't know whether that'll be bandaged up or in some kind of medical hammock, maybe. Perhaps he'll be asked after the game. But yeah, I mean, Everton, like United, have hit a run of poor form, three games without a win. Back-to-back defeats against Southampton and Newcastle. I mean, their recent home record against Manchester United has been pretty good. They put four unanswered goals past United, I think the first time that Solskjaer went there as manager. They've only lost twice in the last eight league meetings at Goodison Park. And given that United are slightly vulnerable, perhaps they, you know, doesn't feel such a bad time to be playing them.
Yeah, that 4-0 game a couple of seasons ago, if you remember, after the match, Solskjaer went on quite a dark rant about the team and said that a lot of them would never play for the club again, and fewer than the people he intimated did leave. So he's got that in him, maybe. But at the same time, for all their bad form, United have won their last six Premier League away games, which is good. They haven't won seven away from home since John Major launched the ill-fated Back to Basics campaign, and you do wonder whether that's what Ollie will be saying in the dressing room this weekend. Let's just get back to basics.
And in further good news for United, it looks like Jordan Pickford's going to be in goal for Everton, right? So perhaps we shouldn't rule out the away win.
You say it looks like, is this on the basis of Carlo Ancelotti when he left him out last time saying he would be back for this game, or has he made further noises?
Yeah, well, he said when Robin Olsen came in for Everton's last game that it was just a one-off and that Pickford would swiftly return. But he used the term rotating the goalkeepers, and he spoke about how he's
over a hot
dealt
fire?
With... perhaps in Pickford's case, that's what he needs. But he spoke about how he has rotated goalkeepers in his previous jobs. I think he referenced Napoli as being one example, which opens the door to there being, you know, more regular switches between Pickford and Olsen that you might otherwise expect. But yeah, from what he said, it looks like Pickford will be given a chance to prove that he's the number one again.
Certainly Olsen losing and being part of the team that lost at Newcastle, not the greatest calling card in terms of securing that place. Sasha, who do Liverpool fans root for in this one?
As a Liverpool fan, looking at this, I tend to take the pragmatic view of who's going to be the greater threat in the long term. And to be honest, at the moment, it's difficult to tell, given that I can't really see United getting much worse. And with Everton, you know, when injuries came in, there was always the question of how are they going to manage them. I mean, looking at this particular game, I'm not really particularly sold on Ancelotti rotating the goalkeepers, because I don't really think Olsen and Pickford are particularly interchangeable. But also, I think if note of optimism for Everton going forward, I mean, having seen how United kind of defended under pressure, and I haven't been particularly impressed. So, you know, if James is back and, I mean, still no Richarlison, but if James is back and Calvert-Lewin is attacking those centre-backs, I mean, perhaps they could have a bit of joy, because again, that zone in front of the defence and the defence itself, when it comes under sort of sustained pressure with, you know, some questions being asked, I don't think it's really up to it.
Okay. All right. Well, there's loads more top fixtures coming up this weekend. So let's have a quick breather and then we'll launch back in with West Ham Fulham.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power.
Monday evening, a select few were able to enjoy Fulham's first victory of the season over West Brom. 2-0 it was on, of course, PPV, pay-per-view. Both West Brom and Fulham are back on the pay-per-view this weekend. West Brom Sunday lunchtime against Spurs. Colin Miller pointing out that's their fourth game in a row on pay-per-view. Baggies fans have had to pay almost £50 to watch their side score one goal and get 2 points against three sides in the bottom four. On the subject of PPV, Thursday, today for us, there's a big meeting apparently with the Premier League, who reckon that it hasn't been a massive success. There are various options on the table, either suspending it for the duration of the current English lockdown, maybe dropping the charges, or indeed scrapping it all together. As it stands, though,
or they could double it, double the price. Maybe it's not premium enough.
Well, that's the kind of blue sky thinking that may very well be dominating the meeting even as we speak. Excellent. Fulham are due to be doing the PPV thing at West Ham Saturday evening. Daniel Story pointing out that four of Fulham's back five against the Baggies had names beginning with the letter A. Duncan, is that a record?
Well, he tagged me in on this, so I was forced to look it up. And it looks like the record in a Premier League game, I had to do a whole team, because I'm not going that deep for Daniel, but it's seven players whose names began with W playing for Sheffield Wednesday against Man City in 1992, which was...
Did they get
Wilson,
a W?
I don't know, actually. I didn't look at that. But it's Wilson, Watson, Williams, Warhurst, Worthington, Woods and Waddle. Sounds like some of those tongue twisters that
oh,
kids
yes.
have to say, but...
Very well delivered. Areola, Aina, Anderson and Adara Bioyo were the other four, the A team, if you will, behind that clean sheet and victory. Fulham, as I say, at West Ham Saturday night, if you want to splash cash on that. Cottagers haven't won a league game at West Ham in 19 years. Ooh, Sasha.
Quick question for Tom. Anderson from Lyon, is he going to be the difference? Because, I mean, this was his first start. They kept a clean sheet. He looked pretty reasonably good. Can he shore up that back line for Fulham?
He was awful for Lyon. He was absolutely he? Awful. He was their record signing from Sampdoria. I think they paid about €35 million and they brought him in and he was going to be the boss of the defence. He was terrible from the start to the extent that he lost his place in the team to Marcelo, Brazilian centre-back, who had kind of fallen foul of the supporters and looked to be on his way out. But Rudy Garcia realised how badly he needed an alternative to Anderson. So he rehabilitated Marcelo's entire Lyon career just so they wouldn't have to pick Anderson. So they were quite happy to have shot of it. He arrived with an amazing reputation. I remember reading about him. He sounded like the sort of, you know, complete modern defender, a kind of Danish Matthias de Ligt sort of thing. But we didn't see much of that in Liga.
All right. West Brom, by the way, beaten by Fulham last Monday, will be hosting Spurs, which is an interesting clash because it pits the highest scoring team in the Premier League, Spurs, against the worst defence in the division. Even worse, to put this in perspective, than Liverpool. That's West Brom. Harry Kane backing into people, Tom, I feel is going to be a motif in this clash Sunday lunchtime.
Yeah, and interesting to note, as I leap upon this opportunity to plug my book, Do You Speak Football? Still available in all good bookshops, that there is no name for this action in the English language. Whereas and we're talking about specifically a player backing into his opponent and sort of crouching down, not challenging for the ball and sending his opponent sprawling to the ground, which Harry Kane did with Adam Lallana, but also managed to win a penalty at the same time. In Spanish, that's known as making a bed for someone. In
Portuguese, hacer la cama.
That's the one.
Right.
In Portuguese, they call it cat's cradle. And in Italian, it's known as a bridge that you
is it?
You know. Apparently so.
I've not heard apparently that, so. But that's
the fact that you haven't heard of that, James, does not augur particularly well.
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean,
but that's what I found.
You
in
could put
my
that
research
on the front of the book as not remembered by James Richardson.
But maybe we'd be more. Maybe we'd look out for that sort of behaviour more if we actually had a name for it. Maybe your sort of repeat, you know, bed makers like Harry Kane wouldn't be able to get away with it.
I like bed making. I mean, in general, but also as a kind of a synonym for that Harry Kane. Mm.
Well, it also
winning.
Serves in Spanish speaking football parlance to refer to players who are conspiring to get their coach sacked.
Really?
You could also say, it looks like they're making a bed for so-and-so because, you know, they're not defending or, you know, they're leaving Demba Ba free to run the length of the pitch and score or whatever.
Just on the subject of, you know, the football lexicon, Tom, and I know you don't like to speak too much about your book, Do You Speak Football? Available not in good bookshops because they're all closed, but, you know, online. Is it your impression that the English game, it has a less rich vocabulary associated with it in terms of idioms?
It does in a way. I mean, I think what happens quite a lot with our sort of native football language is you sometimes overlook the poetry that's in it because we all, you know, use these terms and these idioms and these metaphors quite unthinkingly. And if you take a step back, you realise that actually some of them are quite sort of lyrical and quite elegant. But when it comes to technical terminology, there are gaps. You sort of think that it was almost as if having invented or having at least codified the sport of football and laid down the kind of linguistic breeze blocks of football, goal, referee, penalty, whatever, we then just sort of sat back and thought, well, our work here is done. And it was actually, you know, the Brazilians and the Argentinians and the French and the Italians who were like, oh, well, what do you call this particular skill move? And we said, well, we don't bother ourselves with that sort
we didn't
of behaviour.
Skills until.
Well, no, exactly. You think about skill like Rabona. We never had a name for Rabona because, you know, we didn't really go in for that.
Well,
kind
we
of
did.
Thing.
It was called Get Rid, Stop Messing Around with the Ball.
Exactly.
let's ask Sasha, somebody who is very much steeped in our culture, but at the same time comes at it from a slightly different context. What's your favourite bit of kind of flowery football talk?
In any language?
No, in English.
In English. Yeah, I quite like Get Rid. No, to be honest, man on. I can't think of a favorite right now, but I think Tom makes a good point there that we kind of maybe overlook these expressions as a cliche. Mm. Whereas perhaps in other languages, like in Spanish, you know, make the bed, that's their cliche. Like, oh, this
right.
is really
for example, in French or Italian, is there anything to compare with not for me, Clive, or if anything, he's hit that too well? I don't think so. And they're the poorer for it.
In and around is quite a good one.
In and around. Yeah, the very great Andy Townsend there. Well, we should talk about the football. Duncan, our last line on West Brom Spurs?
Yeah, just anyone with a very arcane memory might recall that Adebayor had 9 shots on target in this fixture in November 2011, which is the most by a player in a single Premier League match. So,
that's remarkable.
Can Harry Kane match that while he's making the bed?
Monday, there was another game that took place in the Premier League, and it saw Leicester go to Leeds and win 4-1. Leicester now second in the table, even though they've only got a British manager, Brendan Rodgers, after this 4-1 victory against Marcelo Bielsa, muttering bitterly, because I'm a British manager, I got lucky. That's the way it works in these games. He has beaten Guardiola and Bielsa this season. Has he got lucky or has he been outthinking the foreign fellas?
I would prefer not to have to frame that matter in such potentially xenophobic terms. I think what we've seen with Leicester is that they are a very effective counter-attacking team. And you look at their most impressive performances this season, they've generally come on the road. You know, that incredible 5-2 win at Manchester City, the 1-0 win at Arsenal, which is a real sort of, you know, counter-punching victory, and then 4-1 at Leeds. And this despite missing an awful lot of players, particularly at the back, and playing with this new look back three. Credit to Brendan Rodgers. We worried a little bit, I think, about Leicester after they hit the skids last season. You wonder whether they'd be able to rediscover the momentum they had in the first part of the season. And as Sasha mentioned earlier when we were talking about Brendan Rodgers' Liverpool side, he is a bit of a momentum manager. And it looks like he's found a decent bit of momentum at the moment. But given that they've generally fared better away from home than they have at home, and that Wolves are really tightened up in their last few matches, I think this could be quite a tight one.
All right, Wolves with Nuno Espirito Santo, of course, who, if he was called Brian Holyname, surely wouldn't excite the same kind of respect, although looking like Morpheus could be the key in his case. But Leicester Wolves is the clash at 2 o'clock on Sunday. It could see Leicester go top of the table by the end of the weekend. As you mentioned, Tom, Leicester are better on the road, 4 wins out of 4. And as you also state, Wolves have really tightened up, just 1 goal conceded in their last 4. So do you fancy Nuno's side then for this one at the King Power?
I think it'll be a draw.
Sasha?
I'm rooting for Maximilian Kilman, who is actually, I believe, Russian-Ukrainian.
No.
Which quite unusually came through non-league football, former futsal international, made a bit of a name for himself at Maidenhead United before going to Wolves. And I think it's quite an unusual footballing story, and I'm keen to see how it develops. And I think he's done very, very well so far, even has an assist.
Who does he play his futsal for?
England. He was born here. Yeah, he was born here to... It's a bit like my son, who's also called Max. Maybe in the future, he also has a future with Wolves. We'll see.
Is Max Kilman your son, Sasha? Is this where this is going?
my son is only 4 at the moment, so he's a few years behind Max Kilman. So we have a roadmap for him to achieve in the next 20 years, I suppose.
Also coming up this weekend is the big showdown of 8th and 9th. That's Arsenal-Aston Villa. That's Sunday evening. Villa actually ahead of the Gunners on goal difference. The two seemingly travelling in different directions. A Palace, who are 2 points behind that pair in 13th, will be hosting Leeds Saturday at 3. Palace have had the fewest shots in the Premier League this season. Liverpool are the only team who've had more shots than Leeds. Saturday at 5:30, it's Chelsea against Sheffield United. Can Frank Lampard's side get a 6th clean sheet against a Blades side that hasn't won since July? No Kai Havertz in that game. He's tested positive for COVID-19. Friday at 5:30. Yep, Friday at 5:30. It's Brighton-Burnley. Interesting to see if Neil Mopay is back in the team after being dropped from the squad for an inflated ego. An incident with a teammate in a dressing room, apparently. And also on Friday, Saints against Newcastle. That one is at 8 o'clock. And Saints will go top of the Premier League if they win this match. Good Lord. They haven't been top of the league in over 32 years. Phil Collins was number one with A Groovy Kind of Love last time it happened.
If they do go top, and even if it's only for one day after the rest of the fixtures, they'll join Ipswich, Forest, West Ham, Wigan, Hull and Huddersfield on one day on top of the Premier League.
Were Huddersfield top of the Premier League?
Presumably in one of the Huddersfield seasons. It would have been early on when they got a win and then, you know, briefly topped it. But Tottenham have been on top of the Premier League for 9 days fewer than Bolton so far, which rankles some Spurs fans. So obviously that could change this season.
Mm. Ralf Hasenhüttl's side, this time last year, were in the relegation zone. Currently they are on a 5-game unbeaten streak after that slightly wobbly start to this season. They won't have Danny Ings fit. They called the scan results on his knee, that injury picked up last weekend, favourable in the sense that he'll only be out for 6 weeks, which gives you a measure of the kind of fears they had for his fitness. Newcastle are unbeaten on the road this season and have won 4 of their last 5 against Southampton.
It's one of the few times you can legitimately and accurately say Ings can only get better, so I plan to do that. This is actually Southampton's first Friday night game since the game we're not allowed to mention anymore because it's been more than a year since it happened. But so let's hope. I mean, I can't really see Newcastle scoring redacted number of goals in this game, but you never know.
Well, listener, about this time, I think it'd be a good moment to drop in on our pal Lee Price and his continuing adventures in and around the world of odds.
Happy weekend, friends. The results are in, but still nobody knows the answer. That's right. Is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer actually any good at football management? Well, plenty of United fans were doing a recount of his worst results following the midweek cock-up, and the trip to Everton isn't exactly the gimme it might have been previously. Although, that might depend on whether Jordan Pickford is reinstated. Solskjaer must have been inspired by Carlo Ancelotti's decisive management when he dropped David De Gea in the Champions League, although that was approximately 9 months too late, and after a run of games where he hasn't actually been that terrible, who'd be a football manager, eh? Well, perhaps not Ollie himself, if this one doesn't go his way. But we do make United the very slight favourites to win. They're 11-8 to take all 3 points. Everton, 9-5. And clearly, we've got some kind of pro-Manchester agenda at Paddy Power, like the opposite of the government, because we also make Man City favourites to beat stronger Merseyside-based opposition this weekend. Weird. Guardiola might be pepped up, God knows he needs it, to hear that City are 10-11 to beat Liverpool, who must, therefore, represent value at 23-10, if you can get your head around the weird numbers. Speaking of weird numbers, Liverpool's number 46, Reece Williams, has been earning rave reviews. I only really wanted to mention him, to be honest, because he spent last season on loan at Kidderminster Harriers, and I once had a holiday friend who supported Kiddy. I've long since forgotten your name and face, but I think of you, well, actually, almost never. Just in the rare times I hear the phrase Kidderminster Harriers. Anyway, enough waffle from me. All the best.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Quick word for Sheffield Wednesday, who have had this week their 12-point deduction for breaching a profit and sustainability rules reduced to 6 points, which moved, excitingly, the Owls off the bottom of the Championship table on Wednesday evening and above Wickham. But then, Duncan?
We can't be kept down by meddling bureaucrats because we won 2-1 away at Birmingham in a very dominant display, yeah.
That's your second win in a row.
7 points in a week, yeah. So we are, yeah, I mean, we're looking at the playoffs now more than the relegation zone. Brackets, we are still in the relegation zone. But yeah, they're playing really well. So
okay,
yeah.
Well, so Sheffield Wednesday, who were off the bottom of the Championship for 2.5 hours, now back in last place. Wickham, if you're keeping track, third from bottom, ahead of Derby and the Owls. 1 point from safety and Coventry. Only two behind fifth last, Nottingham Forest. Crikey.
Who we play this weekend.
Do you? That's huge. Also big news this week, Mick McCarthy's been appointed manager of the fifth best team in Cyprus, Apollon Nicosia. Who's excited about that?
Yeah, I am, because it gave me another chance to listen to the Deep House Mick McCarthy track, which is now on Spotify as well. And it is...
Is it now on Spotify?
Yeah, and as I was explaining to my wife, it's actually really good. Like, you can listen to it in a non-ironic way, which is the hope for everyone.
Right, okay. One last question to finish things off then, and it's from Michael Shart, who says, who's going to win the boxing match between Eddie Hall and Thor? Crikey, Michael Shart, this is big news, and it's kind of wrong that we've left this right to the end of the show, but it's true. Eddie Hall, the Beast, world's strongest man a couple of years back, and Thor, who won it the year after him and who plays, of course, the Mountain in Game of Thrones, have both decided to get it on because, in the immortal phrase, they don't get along. They are going to be having a boxing match, apparently, in Las Vegas. There's some incredibly serious training going on, certainly by Eddie, and I think from Thor as well, who's about 6 foot taller than Eddie is. So there's going to be all sorts of interesting questions for people who know about boxing to do with reach and that kind of thing. But this is going to happen in Vegas in September 21 is the plan, although, you know, plans at the moment very much all penciled in. It's extraordinarily interesting, Michael. I'm super excited to know more about this contest. And it's going to be the first thing that I ask Eddie when I meet up with him this coming Sunday for a long trip to Bradenton, Florida for this year's World's Strongest Man. As a result of that, I won't be with you for the next couple of Totally Football shows, but I'll be sure to be bringing back all the fresh news about that. And, of course, World's Strongest Man, which will be back on your screens for Christmas. And comforted by the knowledge that I'm leaving you in the very capable hands and mouth of Matt Davis Adams. Superb.
There's an image.
Yes. That's it for today. You stuck with us, listener. You're special. We are going to finish up here, though. Many thanks to Sasha, to Duncan and to Tom Williams, and above all to producer Charlie, and above all, you listener. Catch up with you soon. Have a lovely time in the meanwhile.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of the Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on the Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
Muddy Knees Media.